The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
The third one is, when did Jesus call his disciples? When did Jesus call his disciples? Actually, this, you know, one of the most common arguments for the view that the fourth gospel is incompatible with the synoptics is the report in this chapter of how Jesus gained disciples. And as you know, in the synoptic tradition, the call of the disciples is placed at a different time, in a different setting, under quite different circumstances. It's not here in the south, in Judea with John the Baptist, it's up in the Galilee. Jesus walking by and calling, you know, the sons of Zebedee and so on who are fishing or about to. But you've got to be reasonable here. Are we to imagine that when Jesus, if you go to the synoptics and you see that Jesus calls Peter and the others, are we to imagine that these men had never seen Jesus before and that somehow, you know, Jesus is just walking along and he says, come. And these disciples, you know, get into some kind of trance or whatever. You know, that's just not a very reasonable way of looking at the at that particular story. And in fact, again, I think Carson is quite to the point. Page 154 of his commentary, 154, he says, the promptness with which the disciples, according to the synoptic tradition, the promptness with which they abandoned their livelihood in response to Jesus' explicit call is psychologically and historically more plausible if that was not their first exposure to him or their first demonstration of fealty toward him. In other words, now when you read the Gospel of John, you say, oh, no, of course, that makes sense. There was some sort of contact already, maybe even some sort of allegiance. And this is a time when you have a more formal call, and of course they're ready to abandon their livelihood at that point. And again, I think this is obviously a little bit of a different approach from what we were looking at in the other two problems, but one that you need to keep in mind as you come across some of these difficulties in the Gospel of John. When Eusebius makes that comment about supplementing historical, giving information, particularly in the early part of Jesus' ministry. Although I don't think that John necessarily was thinking, they didn't say this, I'm going to say that. I don't think it was quite that sort of thing. But in effect, what the result, whether it was purposed this way or not, the result is that John provides a fuller historical picture that now makes the synoptic story, makes more sense to read the synoptic tradition in ways that were not possible before. And the fourth problem, the reference to Bethany in verse 28, after John the Baptist speaks about the one who is coming after me and so on, we're told that these things took place in Bethany on the other side of Jordan, where John was baptizing. The difficulty is that Bethany here, in verse 28, is one, not the only one, but one of several geographic place names in the Gospel of John that cannot be confirmed archaeologically. There's also Cana, and there are a few other place names that archaeologically or by reference to other historical documents that you simply cannot prove that these places existed. I might say parenthetically, in case this isn't clear to you, that there's probably no writer of antiquity who refers to a large number of geographical place names where you don't have the same problem. And nobody, you know, raises a question about whether these places really existed or not. Okay, we just don't have enough data to prove it, but that doesn't mean that these places did not exist. The problem is with the Gospel of John, that either people come at it predisposed, you know, in terms of the historicity of the Gospel, or maybe they're thinking John is so theological that he's also playing around with the facts to make the theology fit. And so, you know, one of the theories is that Cana is an invented name. It combines the first syllable of Capernaum with the first syllable of Nazareth. And so John is symbolic in trying to say something about Cana. And yeah, it is pretty silly, I think. Brown, I think, deals with it very appropriately. He makes the point that where there is symbolism in John, it generally stems from an ingenious interpretation of fact rather than from purely imaginative creation. He goes on to say, scholars have become more cautious now that some Johannine place names, once accounted to be purely symbolic, for example, Bethesda, in chapter 5, verse 2, some of these names that before were thought to be purely symbolic have now been shown to be factual. And that's, you know, one other element in the new look on the Gospel of John, where writers have realized that you cannot just dismiss them of this kind of material. Now, Brown made that comment back in the 60s. In the late 80s, there was an article published in the Tyndale Bulletin, and Carson mentions that, a fellow named Reasoner, who thinks that this place name here, Bethania, in verse 28, which, he thinks that it is really a reference to Batania, and that would be equivalent to Bashan in the Old Testament place name Bashan. You know, place names, there's a great deal of variety in the spelling of these names throughout, not just in the New Testament, but in Josephus and elsewhere. And if you have any problems with that, you know, if it bothers you to see these spelling variations, you need to remember that you're dealing with a period when there isn't such a thing as standardized spelling as you know it. And all you have to do is pick up, you know, have you ever read Thomas More back, you know, in the 16th century or whatever, and you read that stuff, and the spelling is just totally chaotic. I mean, he will spell the same word three different ways in a short space. So that's not all that unusual. But he thinks that the particular spelling that John chose here was intended to provide some kind of inclusio with Bethany near Jerusalem, which is mentioned toward the end of Jesus' public ministry in chapter 11. And that allows him to tie the prediction about the Lamb of God with the sacrifice itself. That it's pretty... subtle. If it is true, and I take it that Carson likes that handling of it, but if it is true, then you're dealing, I think it would be an example of what Raymond Brown had mentioned before, an imaginative interpretation of fact, not just inventing a place name, but giving the place name with a slight spelling variation that allows John to, again, help the reader associate certain kinds of things. Well, I don't know about that. I just mentioned it as one possibility.
What page are
in Brown's page 45, and Carson talks about this other interpretation by Reasoner in page 147. Well, so much for the historical stuff. Any questions about that? If not, let's go on to the third part, talk about the message of this passage. And more specifically, the nature of the testimony regarding Jesus, the nature of the testimony regarding Jesus. Now, if you want a fairly thorough discussion of this whole topic, idea of testimony. You may be aware that James Boyce did his doctoral work in Basel specifically on that topic, witness, the theme of witness in the Gospel of John. And I don't know if the book is still in print, but you may want to take a look at that. Pages 80 to 88. I'm trying to remember the exact name of the title, but anyway, witness in the Gospel of John, something like that. And I don't want to, you know, try to cover everything that could be said about that. I want to limit myself to a fairly brief discussion of the Christological titles used in narrative. Not to go through them in any detail, but simply to highlight them, because I think that becomes a significant factor that also anticipates certain things that are going to be developed later in the gospel. The first title is Messiah. And as we have seen already, this particular title appears at several points. First, when the Jews asked John, and he denies that he was that he's the Christ. That's verse 20. And again, indirectly, that's a testimony to who the true Christ is. Also, verse 26. I baptize in water, but in your midst is someone whom you do not know. He who comes after me. The actual name Christ does not appear, but there's no question about what we're dealing with. And then also in verse 41, when Andrew says to Simon, "We have found the Messiah," which translated means the Christ. I don't think we need to say too much about that here. Apparently, as you read the narrative, it is assumed that the audience would know what this meant. In other words, John, as he's writing, does not feel any need to elaborate. As a matter of fact, there are certain ambiguities in the title Messiah because of the differing theological ideas in Judaism. But the way that John is going to resolve that problem is just by giving us more and more facts about Jesus as the story develops. But at the very beginning, you're already making the connection. This is the Messiah that we're talking about. Second title or description is the Lamb of God. Lamb of God. This is in verse 29. The next day, he sees Jesus coming to him, and he says, "Behold, hoamnos tu theou, ho iron ten hamartian tu kosmo." Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. The precise nuance of this title has proven very difficult to establish, and commentators have come up with all kinds of ways of, you know, obviously you're dealing with a metaphor, and now what is going to be your point of reference in understanding the figure? Morris, in his commentary, lists no fewer than 9 possible theological interpretations of this title. For example, Maybe it's a reference to the Passover lamb. The Lamb of God is the Passover lamb, sacrificial element involved there. Another possibility, and by the way, as I think will become obvious, some of these possibilities are not mutually exclusive. But the second one, could this be an allusion to Isaiah 53:7, the lamb taken to the slaughter? There could be a connection between the Passover lamb and Isaiah 53, but when John the Baptist makes the statement, is he thinking specifically about the passage in Isaiah? A third possibility, which actually involves the view that there may be a mistranslation involved here, is that lamb here is a way of referring to Jesus as the servant. And the problem here is that there's an Aramaic word, talya, that can mean either lamb or servant. And according to one theory, you know, maybe the Gospel of John was initially written in Aramaic, had the word talya, and somebody came along, translated, didn't check his dictionary, whatever, and translated amnos instead of pais. Another theory that has been suggested is that what is in view specifically is the daily sacrificed lamb, not the Passover lamb, but the daily sacrificial lamb. Others go in a different direction. For instance, are we talking about the gentle lamb of Jeremiah 11, verse 19? Jeremiah 11, verse 19. Gentle lamb. Or could it be the scapegoat in the Israelite cult? Or do we really have a picture that needs to be tied to the triumphal lamb of the book of Revelation? C.H. Dodd liked that one. You may be aware of the fact, or may remember that C.H. Dodd was not real thrilled with the orthodox notion of Jesus being treated or described as someone who takes upon himself the wrath of God, that to him that was, you know, kind of a pagan element, and he does as much as he can to avoid that. And in this particular one, in order to move away from any atonement ideas, he says what we're really dealing with here is a Johannine conception. Not that the book of Revelation was necessarily written by John in his view, but he recognizes that there are some common themes, and that this is what the gospel is giving expression to here. There's also the theory that what is going on here is an allusion to Genesis 22:8, connection with the Akedah. Let me mention that at this point, because Akedah is the reference to the binding of Isaac. And there's been quite a bit written as with regard to whether or not this theme is reflected in the New Testament. And in the Gospel of John, there are a couple of passages, not the least of which is, for God so loved the world, he gave his only son. Some passages in the New Testament that may reflect that very strong Jewish tradition of the Akedah. And so some people think that already it is alluded to here when God provides an offering. Well, you know, number of others. You may also refer to Carson's description of this. I think part of what's going on here is a result of the fact that in 20th century biblical scholarship, there has been a lot of preoccupation, I would say over preoccupation, about the origin and the theology of the Christological titles in the New Testament. And to be perfectly frank, I have never totally understood this. Why some people write whole books on the titles in the New Testament. you know, if you want to understand, if you want to know what somebody believes about something, you look for explicit propositions, actual statements made. And to focus so much, and I'm not saying that, you know, there isn't any value in doing this, but to focus on the titles and then by means that in any case are going to be ambiguous and they're not going to take you as far as you want to go anyway, to try to reconstruct what kind of a theology is associated with that title and how it may have originated. As I say, I think that the proportion of effort that has been given to that may have been a little bit counterproductive. In this passage, the value of this particular passage is that you do not simply have a title, but that the title is defined for you. The Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. So that the sacrificial aspect is simply unavoidable in spite of Dodd's protestations. I think myself that there is a fairly obvious allusion to Isaiah 53. But not to the exclusion of some allusion also to the Passover, a theme that becomes prominent in the Gospel of John. I mean, you have a reference to the Passover in chapter 6, verse 4, chapter 13, verse 1, 18, verse 28, and then almost half a dozen, well, four or five in chapter 19, a couple of which are actual references to Exodus 12. And so in light of the prominence that the Passover theme has in the latter part of the Gospel, it makes all the sense in the world to see that already anticipated here. Whether or not there is a reference to the Akedah, some kind of allusion, I am inclined to think that possibly so, but that would be a little more subtle. In any case, when you read this passage, verses 29 and following, in its whole context particularly, you begin to appreciate the artistry with which the author is getting you to think about some pretty crucial things. And Raymond Brown makes a comment about quote, John's genius at incorporating a whole Christology into one brief scene. A third title is that of Son of God. Son of God, which appears twice in the passage. We already commented on that. Here in the verses 32 to 34, and then also in connection with Nathaniel. But this is so fundamental that I think the best way of handling it is to postpone it until a later point, because we're going to have to deal, in effect, may have to wait until the very end of the semester when we talk about the prologue, and it's only when you really look at the prologue in some detail that you begin to see how this ties so many pieces together. Fourth title is King of Israel. King of Israel. Verse 49, where Nathanael says, Rabbi, you are the Son of God, you are the King of Israel. With that statement, Nathanael gives expression to what would be a natural and typical response, nonetheless, an inappropriate response, by the way, but a natural and typical response to Jesus. not that there's anything wrong in thinking of Jesus, the King of Israel, if you have the right understanding of what Israel is and other, you know, elements involved there. But it seems to me that Nathanael, by this statement, anticipates, if only indirectly, what is going to become an important issue in chapter 6, when the Jews want to make Jesus king. Now, I don't want to make any judgments here about Nathanael's... Well, maybe I do want to make a judgment, I don't know. I'm not terribly sure, but I think that John is at least putting before us the possibility that Nathanael needs to learn a little bit about Jesus. That when Nathanael says King of Israel, he probably is thinking in terms of the earthly political Messiah. It's not said explicitly, but at the very least, by the time you do get to chapter 6, you're not totally unprepared. You're not surprised that someone, that a Jew, would indeed think of Jesus in those terms. And that has its negative, because it probably implies that the person has not yet understood what are the real implications of the coming of Christ. But if the disciples, even after the resurrection, are still asking questions, are you going to restore the kingdom to Israel, that's not surprising. Yeah.
Isn't it deliberate ambiguity? Is it John's way of saying you're right but you're wrong, and letting the statement stand because it is right but not in any way you understand it as part of your learning?
Well, that's sort of what I'm suggesting, but I want to be careful because there's nothing explicit in the narrative here that would lead you to think that John is giving a negative portrayal of Nathanael or at least presenting him as somewhat ignorant of the spiritual reality of Jesus. On the contrary, Nathanael is being portrayed in very positive terms. But I guess I'm thinking that again, if you read the second time you read the Gospel of John, you come across this statement and you might think, well, I guess Nathanael is not really quite as far along as he ought to be. Of course, why should he be? Now, what I'm going to say for the next one may also shed some light on that issue. Yeah. There's something that I'm going to say, and the next term we're going, and it's the last term, is the Son of Man. And there's some things that I'm going to say in connection with that that again may relate to your comment and that comment as well. One of the problems, which in a sense is a historical kind of problem, is that as the Gospel of John describes the ministry of Jesus, he seems to be, how shall I put it? Well, the negative way of looking at it would be to say that John is reading a later understanding of who Jesus is and what he did back into the earlier part of his ministry. Again, the Son of Man issue is one. If you read the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels, aside from two references in the Gospel of Mark that may be explainable on other grounds, the title Son of Man does not really begin to appear until the latter part of Jesus' ministry. And yet here is Jesus using it right from the start. And some people argue that, again, that's an inaccuracy or something. Well, I wouldn't want to say it's an inaccuracy, but maybe, again, think of the cleansing of the temple. If you, and we'll talk about that next time, but if this is the same cleansing of the temple that you have in the Synoptic traditions, and John is relating that story, you know, kind of dislocating it for some purpose, is that another example of John kind of, as he gives you the whole picture, he's taking his knowledge of everything and helping you see some of these things even in the early part of the whole narrative. In light of that, when Philip makes that, you know, this guy has gone to seminary, you know. This is the one of whom Jesus, Moses and the prophets. That might be one way of handling it. The other way of handling it is to say, no, it's really it's a kind of a naive, an accurate, important statement which John presents in a very positive light, but it's very basic. You know, everybody knows that Moses and the prophets predicted a Messiah. And that's all that Philip is saying at that point. Nathanael, again, is presented basically in a positive light. This man is understanding something that is almost surprising. You know, truly, you know, this is an Israelite and so on. Nevertheless, you don't want to give him more credit than he ought to be given. Yeah? Yeah. I guess personally, I'm willing to let the nose into the tent, but not beyond the nose. I have to confess, I am uncomfortable with saying that John the Baptist didn't really say this. You know, that John is putting this into John the Baptist's lips. Maybe there's some way of taking that position, dealing with it in a way that doesn't compromise the historical worth of the gospel. But I think at this point I want to draw the line there. And, you know, how much John the Baptist himself understood in terms of the all the implications that had, that's another question. But I don't think it's at all outside of the realm of possibility that people reflecting on the teaching of the Old Testament would have understood the Messiah to come in some such role. Anyway, the Son of Man issue. The main significance of the use of the title here is that as in the synoptics, Son of Man is Jesus' distinctive self-designation. And presumably in your Gospels course, you know, you talked about this matter, and Voss made a big deal about that. That you know, there's only the one place in the whole New Testament when Stephen, in the book of Acts, refers to Jesus as the Son of Man. Every other place, Jesus is referring to himself. Nobody calls Jesus Son of Man. That is his own self-designation. And Voss makes that suggestive comment that it's probably no mistake that in Christian tradition, in the church, if you look at the hymnody, it is very rare, I guess it happens in a couple of hymns, but Son of Man is not a title used by the church in referring to Jesus, as though unconsciously the church has realized this is the way that Jesus talks about himself. You know, you can overdo that, but I think there is some truth to that whole approach. In this passage, coming as it does at the climax of the narrative, you remember the comment in verse 51. Jesus says to him, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven open and the angels of God going up and down, ascending and descending, epiton huion to anthropo, upon the Son of Man." So here's a climactic scene at the end of the pericope. And you could almost say that Jesus himself here is now gathering all the previous titles that have been mentioned. Son of God, Messiah, King of Israel, so on. Gathering them into this one title. as you know, and I think this has become a strong consensus in scholarship, particularly among evangelical scholars, but not exclusively there, that the advantage of the title Son of Man for Jesus is that this is one label, if you will, that wasn't tied to any one eschatological figure in Jewish theology, and therefore it was just there, ready to be used as a title that could be filled with just the kind of content that Jesus was concerned with. It's almost a commonplace now, but it's an important element that needs to be taken seriously. Terms like Messiah, particularly Messiah, had so much baggage with it in terms of the political concerns that it would be misleading. And so by taking Son of Man, Jesus is able to, just by using it, to give it a particular content. Now, it isn't just the title, of course. It's the whole statement in verse 51 that is striking. The whole verse seems to exude mystery. I suppose in part because the Old Testament passage to which it alludes, Jacob, Bethel, that Old Testament passage also, is a little mysterious. Some rabbis believe that the angels were ascending and descending on Jacob. In the Hebrew, you have just the preposition with the suffix bo, and there's some ambiguity there. The Septuagint eliminates the ambiguity, refers it to the latter, but some people think that when Jesus here speaks about the angels ascending on the Son of Man, could that be reflecting that rabbinic tradition that the angels were going up and down on Jacob himself? However, you can visualize that or not, I'm not sure, but it's, I think, a little doubtful, to say nothing of the problem that you always have of determining whether this kind of a tradition really goes back to the first century or not, and all that kind of stuff. But if it does reflect such a tradition, is it possible that now John, by recounting this statement, he's presenting Jesus as the new Jacob or the new Israel? Does that anticipate chapter 4, where there's a reference to Jacob's well and so on? I don't know. Possibly. There are other elements in Jewish literature that may be relevant here, a tendency to associate Bethel with the manifestation of God's glory, and therefore the Shekhinah, the Shekinah glory, in that context, and there are other possibilities. Raymond Brown comments on page 91, that the half a dozen or so interpretations that have been suggested in connection with this verse, all of them have one theme in common. And here I'm quoting Brown, whether it is as the latter, or the Shekinah, or the Merkabah, another type of rabbinic tradition, or Bethel, or the rock, whatever you think is the specific tying concept, what the vision means is that Jesus, as Son of Man, has become the locus of divine glory. Jesus, as the Son of Man, has become the locus of divine glory. That is the point of contact between heaven and earth. The disciples are promised figuratively that they will come to see this. And indeed, at Cana, they do see his glory. And I think Brown is right about that. Now, Brown does not bring up another issue, and that is the very, very fundamental theme of the ascending and descending of the Son of Man as something that is later developed. Comes up again in chapter 3. No one ascends but the one who descended. And in many other passages, Dodd made quite a bit out of that, And in the past 10 or 15 years, there have been a couple of dissertations and books written just in the theme of the ascending and descending theme in the Gospel of John. So this is going to become a very, very important concept developed in some detail throughout the rest of the narrative. In any case, whether or not you follow a particular Jewish tradition as providing some kind of background, whatever else is going on here, that notion of a manifestation of God's glory, a point of contact between heaven and earth, and you can find that in Jesus as Son of Man. And when Jesus promises you will see this, again, there's probably double meaning involved here. But I think Brown is correct in saying that you're anticipating now the next pericope. Cana, the story of Cana is a crucial stepping stone in the progression of the argument. Here's where the disciples do indeed see the glory of Jesus and they respond with faith. But that's only one in a whole chain of evidences of the fact that Jesus indeed is the one who manifests the glory of God. Well, let me stop there and see what questions or comments you may have. Yeah. In chapter 21, how many fishes? 154, whatever. There has been so much debate over that number. And I think it is in that context that Raymond Brown says, where there's smoke, there must be a fire. And he suggests that just because there has been so much debate on that in the history of interpretation, that he is very insecure suggesting that the number doesn't have some particular significance, though he doesn't know what it is. And there are a few passages like that in the Gospel of John that you have to ask yourself, why is he saying this? Well, the simple answer is, well, because it was a 10th hour, that's all. And I think maybe we need to say to ourselves, there may be some of these cases where that's just what it was. I don't know. The suggestions that have been made, which are not that many in this particular case, but none of them has really caught on. And the other problem, by the way, has to do with just what kind of system is John using here, the Roman system or the Jewish system, and maybe in a different context I may have a little bit more to say about that, but I don't know. I don't think it's at all persuasive, Carson, as I recall, addresses that issue, and I have no wisdom to add to that. I think Carson's case is pretty cogent, and I was trying to remember, there was an article, but I think this article appeared before Carson's commentary came out, so maybe he even alludes to it, where there's some such some comparable interpretation, maybe approaching a little bit different from the way that Brown has it, but I just don't think that's going to work. Later on, in one of the later lectures, maybe we won't get to this until we actually deal with the upper room discourse. But that may be the best place to say a little bit about the arguments in favor of interpolations or dislocations and later redactional insertions and that kind of thing. Even then, I'm not going to spend very much time with it. But Yeah, I don't really have anything to add to Carson's comment. Very well. Talk about Cana next. Wait a second. Is it what day this? Yeah, we're in business. Your quiz is the following week. Yeah.